The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to another Saturday afternoon here on the White Network. Today is August 4th. We are in the summer doldrums, I think. It's vacation time, outdoor activities, yard work to do, things like that. I'm actually a rather exhausted host for you today. I've had a trying past few days, which I won't complain to you about. So it's very good that I have Rodney Martin with me on the program today. He's an energetic type and will have a lot to say, I think. This might be the first program I've done with him in which I'm going to let him do the talking, do as much talking. So that's a kind of inside joke on me. I'm asking Rodney to be patient while I inform you, the listeners, of a couple of things. First, my website has been moved to another server and another internet service provider, and there seems to be some adjustment problems with uploading podcasts and with the mailer service, which I haven't been able to, really take care of properly because I've not been at my own house here and I've been somewhere else and using someone else's computers, so that aren't quite compatible. So some things have not been posted, like the announcement for today's program, which nobody got. So, unfortunately, you have to depend, like so many shows do, on just knowing that when it's on and tuning in then, but it always helps when I send an announcement out. But, and then also some things have not been posted, like some of my last program, on the International Jew that normally would have been. I've had some problem with that, which I will no doubt solve pretty quickly later today. But the reason for the move can be blamed on the ADL. If you're not aware of it, the ADL has been on the war path again and has been going after what they call hate and intolerant sites that put out hate and intolerance. And there's actually a letter at cockroachalley.com, which I've got in front of me right now, which is on the ADL letterhead. And it's written to the Endurance International Group Incorporated, which is an internet service provider. And they say, after in their third or fourth paragraph, our analysis of these complaints indicates that the Endurance International Group host multiple websites, international, I have to move this over, host multiple websites, and the three that it mentions, that it finds distasteful and, are AngloSaxonIsrael.com, which is a Christian identity site, Volksfront, Median, which is in German, which is it gives German media stories, things that are, but obviously from a somewhat right-wing perspective. It's called Volksfront. And then the Zundel site, Ingrid Rimland Zundel's site. And they are telling this company that they want them to cooperate with them and stop hosting these sites. And it's not only this one, but others that they've done this to, and my site is on servers owned by Bill Fink. Well, I guess they're owned by him, but they're hosted at 1&1. They were, and he was, 1&1 has been hosting all kinds of sites of our type for a long time, but suddenly they came down real hard on him and told him that his Christigenia sites didn't want to host them anymore, and he tried to argue with them and tried to talk to them, but in the end, he just had a few days to move everything, which he did. And he's, you know, he's really excellent and works awfully hard at that. And he has everything moved. But there are a few adjustments, I guess, for me that I have to that have to be made. In any event, this is something, you know, this is something that is going on now, that as we make progress with our message, they fight back very hard, and they come down very hard. And so some people have said we need to have our own internet service provider for our programs and for our websites, which is true. We need to have everything of our own if we can manage to do it. So we need to kind of work together in this. That doesn't mean that we have to stop all criticism, because there's going to be some criticism on this program today. Not that I wanted it to be, but I just can't get away from it. It's just too much. It's just too important. It's too much there. So the second thing I want to talk about, I want to say, it won't take very long, but it's I'm haunted when I state things wrongly on the radio. And I want to correct what I said last Monday on the Heretics Hour. I can't wait until this Monday to say it, so I'm going to say it now. I was speaking about the contributors who donated, who sent money to the Carlo Mottogno and his group for the expense of the Einsatz group and book, so they could get what they needed to begin work on that. And I said I didn't remember the names of all of them. But the reason I didn't remember is because I never knew the names. The names I gave you, if you are, even care about this, or if you're listening to that, were the ones that I knew. But I didn't know any others, because I got Carlo Mottogno was willing to let me give out his PayPal address, so people sent directly to Carlo's PayPal address, so that because somebody complained that I was trying to collect the money, and what was I going to do with it and stuff like that. So that's the way that worked out. So I don't know, but they were just telling me, and when I would ask, you know, how it was doing, and they reached the goal of $5,000 really quite quickly. And I named a few people that I knew had contributed on Monday. So that's the story with that. Now, I want to welcome Rodney Martin to the show. Thanks for agreeing to be here, Rodney.
Well, thank you for having me, Carolyn. I think this is my first appearance on the White Network, and I want to congratulate you on a stellar startup of the White Network. It's really been a joy listening to the White Network and the quality content that you've had on there. If I may make a comment about this ADL attack on the internet service providers, I first became aware of this, as you know, I'm a fan of Bill Fink and his content and his programming. Very often, revisionist nationalist shop and purchase their products based on price point. And time again, I've said that is really a bad thing. And I'm sure this company, One-on-One, may have offered a good price. But when
they did, but they also didn't bother anybody until now, I guess.
Well, here's the problem. When this came out, I did some research, and as you are aware, the vassal state that calls itself Germany extends their jurisdiction to the United States. They say if it's against the law in Germany, we'll extend it to the United States. And the ADL is very strategic in what they target. Well, One-on-One is a German company.
Yes, I know that.
So I suspect the reason why One-on-One bailed is because their legal counsel determined that they might get in some hot water in Germany, or the German government could be easily persuaded that they would be violating some of their silly laws that are against freedom of speech, even though everything that's being done in the United States and their subsidiary in the United States is perfectly legal. So I think the ultimate solution, Carolyn, is for us to have our own ISP at some point and be absolutely, protected both, you know, business-wise and by, you know, U.S. law. But I would encourage
everyone. From what you know, Rodney, how feasible is that?
Well, everything's feasible with the proper investment of capital. But there are, you know, there are some ISPs out there that have resisted any attempt by these groups to say, turn this off because we disagree with the content. And, ADL has targeted all of any website they don't like. Even websites like the Family Research Council and such, they've gone out. Council of Conservative Citizens, I understand, have been attacked. But, you know, I think that in the interim, I think and GoDaddy is not one of them. GoDaddy shuts down as well. But I think looking at some really researching and reading the service agreements and such and making it known that if these service providers shut down our websites just because of political pressure, that we're going to respond and sue them for breach of contract. And for the most part, there are some larger ISPs that as long as you're not advocating, you know, any sort of illegal activity, things that are blatantly illegal against U.S. law, they pretty much allowed websites to continue to operate and function and under the auspices of the First Amendment. So I think in the interim, I think that's our solution. I'd like to actually see a co-op. Maybe that would be the first step in getting some nationalist cooperation and establishing an ISP. And maybe that would be the ultimate solution. But it would take an investment in dollars, investment in technical know-how. And actually, I believe, Carolyn, the nationalist movement in this country has all of the necessary tools and talent and resources available to actually do that. And it's just a matter of making it happen.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, I'm now, along with Krista Guinea, has been moved to, I think, is quite a bit more expensive, but it has a history of being stable. But I don't like the email account that I have. In fact, it's one I have with the Ellie Wiesel website, and I don't like the email account I have now as much. Too bad. Thanks, you can. But I do have the email account, so I want to tell listeners that the same thing, Carolyn@CarolynYeager.com. My old one was closed, and I had to move everything, and I didn't know what the situation was. But once I got home, I was able to get into it all right. And so you can, listeners, you can send comments to Carolyn@CarolynYeager.com, and I've got it open right here, so you can, I will be seeing those during the program. So, okay, Rodney, that was very interesting. Tell us now about your website, which you've had for quite a while, but you because of your medical situation and so on, which you've now gotten behind you, you're getting going with it. So whatever you'd like to tell us about that, go right ahead.
Well, sure. I'll give a brief update on where we're at Worldview Foundations. As I'd shared with you in some emails, Carolyn, I determined during my medical downtime, which I had to take for, you know, a period of some months to recovery, and had some minor complications, that once I was able to get up on all eight cylinders, we're really going to hit the ground running, because I was more motivated than ever before to confront the and have a commitment to what I've begun to call historical justice and intellectual justice. So we've really ratcheted up our oral history program, where we're going out and interviewing citizens of the Third Reich who lived during the Third Reich period. We just completed our second one, which was with Mrs. Gretel Hines, who lived in the Sudetenland. It was a 2-hour recorded oral history. Very fascinating oral history. She was originally born of a German family who had immigrated to the United States and then went back to Germany during the Third Reich period after Adolf Hitler became chancellor. So her father wanted to return to Germany. And I'm not going to spoil it. I encourage everyone to go listen to the podcast. What this is resulting in is we're actually moving into active publishing. And I think that's critical, that nationalists and revisionists, you have to publish. You have to get resources out to the next generation. And that's where we're going to win the battle. We're going to win the battle with the current young people. I actually get more emails now from students in colleges now than I do from anybody else, particularly, you know, asking, you know, when are we going to do more oral histories and such. They really want to hear these stories. And so I'm in the process of lining up, scheduling three more oral histories throughout the United States. They're not, I've gotten some commitments to do some in Europe, either telephonically or on a trip that my wife and I are planning in January to Europe. And but those are a little tougher because of the laws in Europe, as you're, which I don't need to go into, everybody knows. But the Germans that are in the United States that we've interviewed have been very, very open and have spoken very openly and candid about what life is really like in the Third Reich. And I encourage everyone to really listen to the Gretel Hines interview. We're going to publish her memoirs. She did an outline, which was originally designed for her family, and it was so well done. We talked to her. I talked to her at length, and we're going to take that and expand upon that and publish that as her book of memoirs, taking the reader through her time in the Third Reich. And then we're also going to publish a translation of Gottfried Feder's famous book on usury. And we're looking at, and that's being translated by Dr. Alexander Jacob, who has become a contributor to Worldview Foundations. We've been printing some of his essays on our website. And then also recently I've been in email communication with Mr. Michael Walsh in the UK, and he's graciously agreed to allowing us to post all of his and any of his excellent essays on our website as well. So we've really been expanding and been very, very busy, and I've been traveling, also lining up locations, and I'm going to have the Third Reich Film Festivals, which I've talked to you on prior Heretics Hours, which I had originally set up for the IHR, which they didn't go as well as I logistically as I'd like to. We're actually going to set them up very professional, and I've identified five locations, conference centers. I've gone out physically, met with the hotels, explained to them in detail, you know, what they are. They're going to be a showing of these historic films from the Third Reich period and followed by a discussion. And so we've identified locations in the Pacific Northwest and in Minneapolis and in Texas. Sound familiar?
Okay. Well, it does, and you always have a lot on your plate, and I usually tell you that you should slow down a little. You're doing too much, but you are full of ideas, and you want to carry everything out. Now, your website is WVFoundations with an S .org, so people can go there, and I listened to the Alexander Jacobs, the podcast that you did with him. And he's a little hard to understand, but I like him very much. You know, with somebody like him, the more he talks, you start getting used to his voice and the way he speaks. So sometimes it's better if he just talks, and you know, rather than back and forth, because every time he got back to him, I was having a hard time understanding him again. So that's just my...
Just that particular podcast. But
he's very good. Yes,
and he just has a new book out on Rosenberg, which is excellent. I encourage everybody to.
Yeah,
to
have
read
you
that
read it?
Book.
I bought the book. I have it, but yes. I haven't opened. I've opened it, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I'm about a quarter of the way through, and he's, like I said, he's going to be doing translation.
It's actually just a translation. He didn't write the book, right?
Right.
It's Rosenberg's. It's a book that's kind of hard to obtain. In German, you know, but he translated it into English, so now we can read it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's just to give you a little announcement. He's doing the translation of the Fedor usury publication, and it is our goal to return as many of these National Socialist publications, you know, the true translation to the public domain as possible, because it's our opinion that they are so relevant today more than ever, given the political and economic dynamics that are taking place. So Dr. Jacob and I have had these discussions, and we think that we want to get as many of the true, you know, translations of these documents back into the public domain. And so we're starting off with Fedor's usury publication, and then we're going to go from there.
Okay, well, that's things to look forward to, and it's great that you are doing what you're doing, Rodney.
It's great to have help. I now have help. I'm getting more help for the podcast. I have a great help person that's helping on the technical side, doing the sound editing, and we're just going to keep getting better and better, I think, and it's exciting.
Well, that's good. That's good. Yes, it is. All right, well, let's go on to some of these stories in the news about the Olympics. A big one about the German female rower who was returned to Germany over the idea that she has a right-wing boyfriend. And then there's also a Greek girl has gotten on the Greek Olympic team, has gotten in trouble for her statements, which are not in accord with the thinking of the Olympic Committee or anything in the world, in our world today. So let's start with the German rower. And, you know, I don't have that story in front of me, so I hope you do.
I do. Yes, I have both of
okay.
them.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, you kind of give us a rundown of that. I think most people who are listening are aware of that. So just a quick rundown, and then we'll just talk about how disgusting it all is. What
well,
they're doing,
you know,
basically.
It's kind of interesting because her name is Nadia Draigala is her name, and it's interesting. They say that she was suspected of having right wing ties, so therefore she was removed from the team, and of course sent home. It says also then later it says she has voluntarily left the Olympic Village, and an investigation may follow. And then over on another German publication, it said that her crime was that her boyfriend was a member of the NPD, which is a legal political party, which holds seats, you know.
Make that clear. You said
yes.
Legal. You didn't say illegal.
Legal. Yes. But her crime is one of nothing. We need to make this clear. She earned her way onto the Olympic team. Obviously, this was known. I mean, or if it wasn't known, so what? But her crime, apparently, is that her boyfriend is a member of a legal political party, which holds seats in several, in state, what we would call state legislatures in the United States, to keep it simple for our listeners in the United States. Her boyfriend is a member of that party. They haven't said that she is, and that she may have marched with him in some march somewhere, but they haven't proven that. So she's been removed from the team, but yet she's voluntarily left, and they may investigate this.
Oh,
and
she has been removed from the team. I didn't see.
Well,
that.
There's two different stories circulating. It's been very vague. But here's the broader issue, Carolyn, and I'm going to cross-reference it with what happened to the Greek girl. It's kind of interesting. It first happened to the Greek girl, and I'm not going to even try to pronounce her name because I have problems with the Greek pronunciation. But a young female, and I really want to stress that so far they have expelled or run off, we'll use it simply, run off two female athletes for having nationalist viewpoints or being linked to nationalist viewpoints. In the case of the Greek female, she was a member of Golden Dawn, and she had posted a very innocuous, very vanilla. I showed it to my wife. I showed the joke to my wife. It was a posting on Twitter before the, I guess, you know, had nothing to do with her Olympic performance. Both of these females, girls, young women, had earned their way onto the Olympic squads and were competing. And somebody, and I think, you know, this is the question that needs to be asked, somebody has been pouring through Facebook and Twitter and all these social media and targeting female athletes and been sorting out. And if you have nationalist viewpoints or linked to nationalists, you're out. Now, I'm sure if you are married to in a mixed race relationship or writing postings embracing the fall of European Western Christian culture, you know, they want you to participate in everything. They'll probably give you a gold medal just for having those viewpoints. But why is it you have white females who have expressed a nationalist viewpoint that has nothing to do with their Olympic performance? They've already earned their way onto the squad, have been performing, and they get sent home. And they're going to investigate this. They're going to investigate a thought. Now, the most telling detail of this whole thing is they interviewed the IOC spokesman in regard to the young Greek athlete, and they said, quote, his quote was, "People just have to be careful how they express themselves," end quote. There you go.
Why do they have to be careful how they express themselves?
Well, that's it. You know, and I'm going to be posting.
Why can't we express ourselves the way we think without getting, well, we know in the media everywhere, it's not just these Olympic people. Everywhere you have to be super, super careful how you express yourself.
Well,
if you're a public guy, if you're going to be quoted and it's going to be in the newspapers.
You know, in 1968, you had Olympians that would not salute their flag, U.S. Olympians, three blacks. They held the black fist up in the air, and there was no repercussions there. You had subsequent political, you know, anti, what you would call clearly anti-white or anti-Western, anti-Christian demonstrations, and there's been no discipline there. It just seems to me that somebody somewhere, and I'll let the listeners decide for themselves who they think is doing this, somebody has a lot of time on their hands to be pouring through the tweets and the Facebook accounts of athletes from Western European nations. Because I don't know of anybody that's going through that tweets of the nations of Israel, who athletes may have posted tweets about liquidating Palestinians, or how about Robert Mugabe's athletes talking about take more land from the white farmers? Have we looked for tweets along those lines? I'm just looking for consistency and absolute ludicrous policy about expressing themselves.
Well, there is none, and we know how they operate. Now, did Golden Dawn is a legal political party? Of course it is, because they've got people in the parliament now. So, again, just like the NPD, I mean, it's legal, even though the powers that be would like to make it illegal.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so they hold this against these two women, that their political affiliation. And what did somehow I missed what you said, what this tweet was. What did she say in it?
I will tell you the exact what the exact joke was. She posted a joke about African immigrants moving into her country. And again, it had nothing to do with, I'm pulling it up right now, Carolyn,
you know what? I remember now, I did read it, but I've forgotten it. So tell us what
it says, quote, she had posted a tweet reading, "With so many Africans in Greece, at least the West Nile mosquitoes will be eating food from their own home," end quote. Now, that is vanilla. That is vanilla compared to some of the...
When you're talking about Africans, and when you're talking about black people, it isn't anything.
Can you imagine, Carolyn, if she'd have posted something about homosexuals, they would have kicked the entire team out of the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, this is it's persecution. You know, I really feel for this Nadia. I should feel for the other one, but I haven't really read about her too much. I haven't seen.
Well, I feel for both of them.
But I do have this. In fact, I think I'm going to use this picture of Nadia that somebody sent me. Beautiful, beautiful face, front facial view.
Both of them are beautiful women. And there's a
I'll bet. It's always the beautiful women who have pride in their race.
They are targeting, you know, the Greek young lady. You know, they have a beautiful picture of her marching in, holding the Greek flag behind her, clearly proud of herself, proud of who she is, proud of her nation. And, you know, she posted, this type of really innocuous type of joke. And for anyone to think that the influx of the, you know, African immigrants and the other into Europe has had any sort of effect other than negative, they're fooling themselves. But both of the pictures, if you look, pull the story up, you'll see both of them are just beautiful young women. And they're targeting. It's kind of funny that they're targeting women. And I think for a significant reason, because they don't fit the stereotype that the and the narrative that they want to associate women with nationalists. They don't want to see young, fit, educated, well-spoken women associated with the nationalist cause at all.
You're right. And you know, now first, in Europe, nationalism is really considered a crime. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically, it's not, they haven't been able to actually criminalize it yet, but it's, politically, it's seen that way. It's seen as, well, you're an extremist if you're a nationalist.
Sure.
And you're suspect, and so they have to have you on their list, and they have to check you out and give you a hard time. So there's that. But also this thing about targeting women. I think we talked about this a long time ago once, and it is very true that they, like, I remember when in about a year ago or so in Germany, the newspapers were running some stories about women in the far right, and they were clearly upset and wanted to put fear in women of associating with the far right, because they would be exposed like these women that they were exposing, because they don't want photographs, and they don't want the German people to see pictures of far right gatherings, what they call far right, with women and children and families and decent looking women, nice looking women, intelligent looking people. They don't want the German people to see that, because their whole thing is to portray the far right as a bunch of skinheads and mm-hmm. With the big boots and so on and waving flags around. And this is absolutely true. And they were really on a newspaper. The Spiegel was heading that. But they were all doing it. They were featuring these stories where they were demonizing a particular woman that they would find. And then they found some women who, you know, that thing they do, who used to be in the far right, and then they woke up and realized that they were in a cult and they were being brainwashed, and now they were working so hard to try to, you know, warn people about it and all this stuff.
The hypocrisy, well, a couple of things they do. You know, the hypocrisy of these multiculturalist titans is so enormous, it's mind-boggling. On one hand, they'll say you can't make fun of anybody or anything, but yet if you're a nationalist, what do? They find a picture of some poor soul that is morbidly obese, completely doesn't fit, you know, the ideal, the Hollywood ideal of a beautiful person. And they say, look at this, look at this, look at this. And, of course, that person may not even be in the nationalist group at all. So they're contradicting their own egalitarian viewpoint. And then, of course, you see these, you know, they see that they feel threatened by these athletes at the Olympics, because that's a role model for young person to say, well, wait a minute. Here's two beautiful blonde hair, blue eyes women, young women who are proud of who they are, where they came from. They're nationalists, and they are, you know, we've talked about this before, Carolyn, that it's the next generation, it's the young people that we really need to work on, and then here's perfect role models for them, and what do? They bring the hammer down on them. You need to be careful how you express yourself, or you will not be able to be a professional athlete. You won't be able to compete in the Olympics. You have to, what their idea is their idea of a beautiful white woman is Heidi Klum, with an African on their arm, with mixed race children, not these beautiful women who are proud of who they came from and want to protect their bloodline that's been in the, you know, that's been uncontaminated for, you know, generations.
Yes. Well, has that the one with Nadia and the rowing team, the German rowing team, have they finished all their competition? So is that over for her? So by her going home, it doesn't change anything? Or is there some more that for them to do?
I'm not sure. I just became aware of this one. I was focusing on the Greek saw the news this morning about Nadia this morning, and so I started reading it. And of course, then I got invited to a radio show this morning.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought I had it here, but I don't have it. I don't have it where I'm.
I don't believe I'm looking at it right now, because I caught it. Der Spiegel just broke the story this morning.
I don't think so.
It's their lead story.
Well, it might be new, but I mean, it might be a furtherance of it. But
yeah.
But this came out a couple days ago. It's a few days ago. But anyway, well, whatever. We can look.
I just think it's interesting. Yeah, the head of the German Olympic official said that they were just aghast that someone could be on their squad that had xenophobic views or associated with anyone that had xenophobic views, obviously alluding to her boyfriend. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible.
It is. And, you know, you always hope that the people, the folk, are listening to this and are saying, boy, this is really stupid and this is wrong. And then they see that beautiful, she's a real flaxen-haired, blue-eyed beauty, see her looking so innocent and nice. And, you know, you hope that they can put the two and two together. They're just unwilling to speak out. And if they do, you know, they have real consequences. So
to answer your question, they are done, Carolyn. They are done. They are done. Oh. They were done Tuesday. But the DRV, the German, their equivalent of the German sports league, intends to investigate her private life once the games have concluded.
Now, what kind of a medal? I think they were winners, weren't they? Did they get a gold or something?
The story that I'm reading. German Girls. Doesn't indicate what they received. It just says that they were done on Tuesday and that they were going to investigate her private life. So,
well, I think they were very, very successful. And what could happen? Could it happen? I mean, there would be a lot of opposition to it. But if they would decide that she was somehow unwholesome and they would take away the award given to the team because she was a part of it, I mean, that would be going really, really far. I don't know. They couldn't justify it. But
what I found interesting is the German publication, international publication, the English one called The Local, which I'm not really a fan of, which is traditionally leftist, Marxist, multiculturalist. The comments on that publication was 90% in her favor, talking about how dare they punish her just, you know, for being in a, you know, for her relationship with her boyfriend. And they didn't even care that she may have marched. The fact that she had been on the squad had earned that. It was kind of interesting that even the lefty loons on that publication in the comments, and there was a significant number of comments, were in her favor.
Yeah. Well, that's becoming more and more common, that you look down in the comments and you find that the comments are from people who make sense and understand and say good things, whereas the stories are the usual crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think the more they overreach, the more people begin, particularly the young people, will begin to question why are the Marxist thugs suppressing any discussion of topics? And I think that works in our favor more and more.
Well, if they're going to start coming down on our internet service providers too, and push us, try to, you know, get our websites taken down and so on, that is also, I think, going to wake up a lot of people who are a little more subdued. And, you know, I felt very safe about that particular part, because mostly all these websites have been going along with a few exceptions. And maybe that's the kind of thing where they say, well, it hasn't happened to me, so I'm not worried about it. And then finally it happens to you, kind of like that thing of they came for the.
Yeah, Pastor Niemöller's famous poem.
Yeah, Niemöller's thing, yeah.
I know that I was very choosy when I set up my website. I wanted to make sure, because push comes to shove, Carolyn, ISPs are just another company that would easily succumb to pressure. And so I know I was very choosy, and I was willing to pay more. And I really reviewed the contract and made sure that I had recourse that if somebody tried to make trouble. So I made the calculated decision to pay more to be with a bigger company that I knew would, and it had a history of standing up for the First Amendment, and it was truly an American company and didn't have any ties or wasn't a subsidiary.
Yeah. Okay, well, do you have any more current stories that...
Well, there is one out of Germany, and I thought it's just a novelty. And if I could share it real briefly, it just goes to show you just how absolutely silly things are. And this was on, and you know, I try to keep up on the silly and mundane. Germany was proposing to introduce, it was 37 sites under UNESCO protection, historic sites, you know, inclusion. And all of a sudden there was a big brouhaha over there, including, you know, cathedrals and sites going back to the Roman Empire, and even sites going, you know, relating to Martin Luther. And all of a sudden...
Okay, hold on before you continue with that. I just got an email message. Well, I just looked at it from someone who is telling us that a male athlete from Switzerland got the heave-ho for saying something about the Koreans. Well, I haven't been reading all that, but that I'm sure he's right about that, or he or she. I assume it's
So there you go.
Yeah, once it gets started, they have to be fair, I guess. So if they kick out a couple females, they have to look at everybody. And now who knows what this guy... But Switzerland, you know, that's where you find people who are the more traditionalists from places like that. And he said something about the Koreans. Well, we'll have to find out what it is.
You know, let's be clear, Carolyn, before I finish the thing about the historic sites. These Olympics are being held in London. London is the creme de la creme of, you know, London, England has given their empire away to become the capital of multiculturalism. And, you know, under the current queen, they've gone from the British Empire to the multicultural empire. They have street cameras up if you utter anything. And the opening ceremonies of the Olympics here in London were basically a celebration of multiculturalism. And this was brought out by one of the British MPs who himself was criticized and was fired as some assistant to the British prime minister for attending a costume party. And the costume of his choice was a German military costume. And he was fired from as some sort of assistant to the prime minister. He is still a British member of parliament. And he tweeted himself that the opening ceremonies for the Olympics was nothing but a bunch of leftist multicultural rubbish, quote, end quote.
Yeah.
So they set the standard from the opening ceremonies.
Well, that's right. And somebody said that that in the newspapers, the family that was attending the Olympics, that the papers decided to kind of play up as the typical British family who was at the Olympics, was a black man, a white, English woman, and their two mulatto children. That was the typical British family they were showing.
Oh, sure.
At the Olympics. Now, you know, this listener has sent the link, so I have it here. This Swiss fellow's name is Michel Morganella, and he's been expelled from the games for a racist tweet. This tweet business. You better be careful what you tweet to people. I don't tweet, so. Okay.
We do have a tweet, and you know.
And now his tweet account has been deleted.
Sure.
I guess maybe they don't want anybody to see that. I don't know. But it says that what he said was, Switzerland lost 2-1 to South Korea a day earlier, so he was kind of burned at the Koreans. Maybe he thought they did some things that weren't fair. You know how it goes in sports. And, you know, it used to be in sports, there was this feelings that teams would have against one another. And nobody got all worked up about it. But now everything has to be totally politically correct, which is going to ruin sports. It's ruined everything. It ruins everything. But here's what he said. It's not really an exact quote. It says that in the tweet he said he wanted to beat up South Koreans and that they should burn. They put that word in quotes, burn, and that they were... quote, a bunch of mongoloids. Well, you know, so he was mad. You know, I mean, this kind of thing. You know, back in the days, what are some of those? I can't even think of them now. Wops and, you know,
yes,
words like that and heinies and, well, there's a worse one for Germans. And stuff like that, you know, nobody thought anything of it. You can't talk like that now. You can't do anything now.
What they want people to do is to constantly look over their shoulder before they talk. And I think that is it's absolute nonsense. Big Brother is watching. And, it's that Orwell's Animal Farm type of mentality. And what's next? I mean, we have to always, in our mind, edit our thoughts and speak and words before we speak them? No, and I've actually heard worse things than that when I used to pick up my grandmother from the beauty parlor, from little old silver-haired ladies, you know, talking. I mean, you'd be surprised what I would hear when I picked my grandmother up at the beauty parlor, you know, some of the what we would call ethnic jokes, Carolyn. I mean, it is absolute silliness where, you know, where we've come to. I'm frankly surprised, you know, Carolyn, with the egalitarianism and the multiculturalism in the London Olympics, why they even have the medals. They should just give everybody a medal. There's no winners or losers because that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. There's no competition. Yeah. Oh, well, you're supposed to just be so, you're supposed to love your competitors and so on. I mean, you lose your edge when you get that way too much.
Or on the flip side of that is all of the third world athletes are allowed to start the race 10 feet ahead of the white Europeans. Affirmative action.
Well, right. Well, I want to thank that listener for that information. That was really nice. And now I have an email from Hanning Scott about your fetters. I didn't know you were talking about fetter when you said that.
Yeah.
Okay. F-E-D-E-R. Okay. I didn't connect that. Well, Hanning says he's already translated Fetter's manifesto. He said it just had a few bugs left to work out, so he hasn't published it yet. He says if Jacob is working on it, then I need to wrap it up as soon as possible. A little competition there, I guess. You know, Hanning Scott's pretty good. You know, he does a lot of work on his own. He does a lot of translation. He translates from German to English. And he also, like Jacob, translates things that haven't been translated.
Yeah.
So obviously he did this. And so you might want to get a hold of him.
Yeah, we're publishing that entire there's been some of the work, but we're actually going to publish the entire document. And actually, we're looking at several, as Hattie's done, we're looking at some of those rare documents that are just sitting there that are very, very, very relevant. And we got a list. It's going to be fun. Of course,
the more people doing it, the better. It's, you know, that makes all of us people like me very, very happy to have.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we need. We need more translations.
I have a plan. I want to get it put in actually into libraries and in some of the halls of academia, and that's going to be fun. That process is going to be fun.
Okay, so now go back to where you were, where I interrupted you.
They're submitting. The Germans are submitting these historic sites. And, you know, they go back to King Ludwig's castle. I mean, the sites back to, you know, Rome. And all of a sudden, somebody put the brakes and said, hold on. None of these sites have anything to do with the quote, and this is their quote, not mine, the nation's rich Jewish history. And so they consider this to be a crisis. Well, my Lord, I mean, it just goes straight. They can't do anything. Germany has a rich German history. And what is wrong with submitting the sites and moving forward? I mean, that's a question. Well, okay. Why is this a crisis? Why is this even, you know, the sites that they're submitting? Look at the list. You know, stand on their own. You know, they have merit. I mean, why is the fact that there's nothing relating to their quote rich Jewish history, whatever that is, you know, that's not even defined, and they don't
this
even have.
This is sickening.
Any
so, you know, I haven't seen this story or this information. Yeah. So the Jews are saying that sites that don't refer to Jewish to Jews having a part in them should not be a part of this index of German.
They're considering it to be rather insensitive that none of these 38 sites have anything to do with it.
Oh, none of them. Oh, none.
Yes. Well, so what?
Sorry,
so
I wasn't
what?
Thinking.
So what? And I'm as I'm perusing the article, I'm not seeing that it proposed any sites that have anything to do with the Jews' rich contribution.
Maybe the rich history of Germany does not really include the Jews like the Jews want everybody to believe.
Rothschild banks don't count as rich. I mean, I'm not understanding what they're looking. I'm just not understanding the logic. But what I'm here is something that is, you know, would be an outstanding process, you know, where they're honoring, you know, German historical site, and they just can't even do that without, you know.
And of course,
the Holocaust has been there, you know, they're bringing all of that up. They're bringing up the genocide and all of that, and the little violins are playing, and then I just click out of the article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't,
everything that the Jews do is written up in the media. So that makes it even more so that at one time you wouldn't even have read about it, that Jews are complaining about this or that, you know, I mean, and there wouldn't have been anything come of it. But now they control, not only they have their own media, which is quite extensive and gets into, you know, into our hands, and then they have, and then they control our media, so, or the regular media. So everywhere, everything the Jews do or any Jew says, you know, is played up in a big news story like it's important. And we get the idea that, oh, this is important, when a lot of it isn't, except that as they get more power, they're able to put power behind it. But it's just, well, you know, we just don't have enough workers, enough people, enough media of our own to document all this stuff that goes on and put it in perspective. That's important, too.
Well,
because people see this and they think, oh, well, you know, the Jews are being ignored here. Oh, there's, you know, more prejudice, more anti-Semitism against the Jews. How many people who see that will think that? They'll say, well, 38 sites, it must have been, should be some with Jew, where the Jews played a role. Well, you know, this needs to be put into perspective.
You know, it's almost, as the old saying goes, the Jew cries out in pain as he strikes you. There's a prime example. I mean, I'm just not understanding, you know, my first reaction when I read that was, so what? How does that, why is that a crisis? You know, why does that warrant, you know, any marginalizing the significance of the other sites? And there was some discussion about whether there's a cemetery near Hamburg or outside of Berlin, a Jewish cemetery. That pales in comparison to Ludwig's castles and the other sites that they were talking about.
I mean,
the logic is just fleeting. So that's just a, you know, laugh of the day for what we could, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right, anything else?
No, I just thought, you know, something to get the blood pressure up.
Well, we were going to talk a little bit about some recent things, and we're going to talk a little bit about Mark Weber again. I can't seem to get away from Mark Weber. And you know Mark Weber pretty well,
yes.
And because you're on the program today, it's just impossible to pass that by. So, you know, I will mention, I guess, before we go to our 1 hour break, that I did post a blog entitled, let's see, what was it called? Everything that Greg Johnson knows about the Holocaust he learned from Mark Weber. That title came to me after I finished it, and I had some other titles that I wasn't real crazy about, and then that came to me, and I thought, well, that's very provocative and maybe sounds kind of smart alecky, but I'm going to use it because, you know, good titles are important. So I posted that there. I've had a few comments about it underneath it. And this is posted at the White Network because actually I couldn't post anything at my website. So it finally dawned on me that, gee, I can post things at the White Network. And now I'm glad because that woke me up to the fact that I've been thinking I'd like to have some blogs there. And this actually fits here better. I'll put it on my website when I get that everything straightened around there. But in the meantime, you find this at the White Network. And if you just go to the front page, you'll see it on the slider on the little feature thing that we have there that moves for the last five posts or so, and you can go to it. So I wrote that thinking that I would just finish off all the discussion and comment boards and things I had been coming up with and some of the research I did, because I came upon this this radio program. I don't know how. Somebody told me about it, I guess, and I went looking for it. A radio program, an interview that Peter Schenck did of Mark Weber. And everything he said in there, this was in 2009, Rodney, and everything he said in there was exactly what Greg Johnson was saying. And I already knew that Greg Johnson had taken from had repeated things from Weber that he wrote in that article, how relevant is Holocaust revisionism. And that article was, of course, written in January 2009. And then this radio interview was done in February 2009. So, you know, they're tied together. But it's interesting how when people talk on the radio, they're a little more free. They don't edit what they say quite as much as you can do when you're writing and you're putting out something that is important and to you, you know, an important public statement, and you're going to go over it quite a bit and polish it up. So I use that also, but that's what got me to think I've got to write this something on this. I've got to put this down. So I had been working on that for a few days. And so we will talk about that a little bit, and we will go on into some of our own experiences, because that tie in with some radio programs that you and I have done in the past on the same subject matter that Mark Weber has used, and kind of strange timing. And, we will, and also your experiences, if you don't mind, talking about some of your experiences with the IHR. We might as well just do it. I don't know. We don't have anything else planned except that. And again, I don't want this to be any kind of a witch hunt, but so people realize that what we're saying is documented. It's not just opinions. It's not making things up. It's taking from what people are actually saying and doing. So we'll do that, when we come back, and I'll just repeat to you, because I've still got 30 seconds, that Rodney's website is Worldview Foundations with an S.org, and you might want to go and take a look at what he's got there. He's just been building that up kind of slowly. I don't know how it will. I don't know what all plans he's got for him, but I know he has plans for a lot of activities. So that's it, folks, and stay with us for this 5-minute music break, and we'll be back.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while? Need the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave it a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame, in an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in the brown leather frame? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gun firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference, to his fellow man, to all generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as he lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall? A young Willie, my bride, I can't help wonder why. To those that lie here, know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again, and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drums?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Let me get my SkyCon program, make sure I'm on the air. All right. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn program, and my guest is Rodney Martin. Now, we're going to start a new segment here, and I would like to introduce it as this song that you just listened to that I've been playing during the break on this program. Tells us we are dealing with very serious issues. We're dealing with things that have serious consequences, terrible, you know, death in massive numbers and genocide of white folks and serious things. So this is not we can't shy away from things that need to be said, and we can't think that, and we don't think that that I ever have any intention of entertaining people by gossiping or trying to tell tales on people or anything like that. I do not see myself in any way, shape, or form as an entertainer. I really don't like the fact that I think too many people who are listening to these programs want to be entertained. Although, you know, people have different likes and dislikes, and they like some personalities better than others, and they and there is, I guess, a place for entertainment, but I'm just such a serious person that I seldom think about entertainment for myself. And I think sometimes if you're talking about other people in the so-called movement, it might seem like you're gossiping or trying to get listeners or something, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is that wanting to get at the truth of what's going on. And, you know, as someone who's kind of, in a sense, not an insider, what is that? What is that noise? Not an insider. I guess I look and I start seeing things and I say, gee, what's going on here? Rodney,
yes.
What have you got turned on?
I don't have anything turned on.
Well, what is that noise?
Oh, I think there's somebody outside the office here doing something.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, that's loud.
I will shoo them away.
Okay, thanks. I'll continue my little soliloquy here. All right, so what an office, huh? We're dealing in serious things, and we need to look at everything closely and carefully. And so I want Rodney to talk about something that he wrote, but I wrote this this article about
that has been taken care of, Carolyn.
Yeah, I can tell. Thank you very much. Gee, that was really something. I was scared me. I thought, what's this going to be? The question I kept my recent article that I just posted yesterday. Everything Greg Johnson knows about the Holocaust. It sort of took care of it. I guess they went down the street a little ways.
Yeah, they went to go work someplace else for a while.
Okay, well, I can still kind of hear it, but not so bad. Maybe they'll keep moving.
Yeah, they're down. Yeah.
Okay, I just kept it to wanting to compare the similarity between what Greg Johnson had come up with in 2012, just published in June, and what Mark Weber had come up with in 2009 and published, and the striking similarity of the wording is just unmistakable. That the latter was taken from the latter was taken from the former. So that was a point I was trying to make. And so in a sense, I'm questioning the relationship between these two and what that might mean, or if there is a relationship, and there seems to be some kind of relationship going on. And I think that Rodney can shed a little light on that. Now, Rodney, you on your own, Robert Stark's program when he interviewed Greg Johnson, and Greg was talking about his article, Old Right and New Right, and then you went and read the article, and it made you so angry that you wrote a letter to him, and then you either wrote your own article and then did a podcast, or how did that go? But anyway, you want to...
Yeah, if I can just... I think it's important, Carolyn, as one of my friends has pointed out, and I think it's really important to look at Greg Johnson and the tragedy of the IHR in this light. We are essentially at war. Western Christian civilization is under siege by these Judeo interests. They make no bones about it. They have long since ceased operating in the shadows. They now operate openly. They have seminars at USC, UCLA. You're aware of that. It's posted on the website. So keeping that in mind, I think it's important that we operate from a position of strength, and that we do not and we cannot, as nationalists and revisionists, and I actually think that the two must be linked, because what they do, our opponents do, is attempt to hijack, steal, and distort our history. And if our history is hijacked and distorted, then our foundation is essentially, we have nothing to pass on to the next generation. They go to schools, these horrible things called public schools, and they're taught that we've engaged in genocide. And then you go to this, quote, new right, people that say that they are for quote unquote ethno-nationalism, and that they're nationalists, and they are conceding this narrative. Our kids go to these things called public schools, and they're heard that, you know, National Socialism was evil. They engaged in genocide.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they hear it. So it's important. That's the foundation. So yes, I did see Mr. Johnson's essay. I first heard his podcast, and I was enraged. I was righteously enraged. And so I penned a personal email. I did not post it up, you know, for public purview. I penned him a personal email in which I took him to task. I did not use any profanity, but it was very strongly worded based on what I thought was his intellectual dishonesty and his lack of knowledge of true national socialism, where he just got it wrong. to basically concede the Jewish narrative. And, you know, Vladimir Lenin had a term for people, you know, said there's lots of useful idiots that are could be used as pawns in the cause of Marxism and communism, and, you know, who would carry their water. And I really believe that's where Mr. Johnson and this quote-unquote new right was going. And I thought, well, you know, there's one shoe. That essay and that podcast, you know, where is the next shoe going to drop? And so he and I had this exchange, and his reply to me was not one that I would consider coming from an academic PhD. In fact, my opinion is his PhD means pile higher and deeper. But
hey, you know, speaking of the PhD, I need to bring that up while we're at it. Or
sure,
I am concerned, and I've expressed this that he is he won't say where his PhD comes from. And I don't know of any major person in, you know, on the internet or wherever who has a PhD and is called doctor. Yesterday's Deanna Spingola program, she kept calling him doctor. She loves to do that. Calling, you know, I've never heard anybody else call him doctor, but you know, just because somebody has a, says they have a PhD doesn't mean that you should go around calling him doctor. But anyway, I have learned that he doesn't want to say where his PhD comes from because he doesn't want to help the ADL or the SPLC to look into his past and, you know, say anything about him. And I don't believe this at all. I mean, this is not credible. The ADL and the SPLC, if they want to find out where he went to school, they can find that out. But come on. You know,
well, I'm sure.
So the reason of not giving this is because he doesn't want the rest of us to look into his past and to learn anything about him. He keeps himself as quiet as possible. Now, I don't mind people wanting a certain amount of privacy, but if you call yourself a Greg Johnson PhD, you really need to say where you got your PhD, or why would anybody even believe it? I mean, why should anybody have to believe it if it's a secret?
Well, I'm assuming that I think some of your perceptions are correct. I think he wants to have one foot in the pool and the other foot out. I think that frankly, I'm no longer, based on his writings and his stated positions, I'm not convinced that he is really a nationalist in the truest sense of the term. But as to why is there not a biography on, you know, who the director is of the New Right and Countercurrents and what his academic credentials? He presents himself as a scholarly individual. And at least I will say this for Mark Weber. Mark Weber gives his pedigree. You know where what his academic pedigree is.
Well, this was done a long time ago, you know, when people did that. But now, you know, we have people giving excuses.
Yeah, and I understand. Here's the fundamental issue. If you are going to engage in the nationalist cause and in defense of your kindred, you should assume that you are going to draw fire. You should assume that people are going to, you know, the ADL and those other, you know, groups are going to poke around and try to cause you grief. If you're not up to that task, then you better go work at McDonald's or get a dry teaching job someplace and just assimilate. If you're not willing to, you know, walk that walk, then it's, you know, sorry. Why he won't reveal that, why we don't know that information. Is it really truly relevant? Probably not in the overall scheme of thing. I think my issue is his two essays. And like I said earlier, I was waiting for the second shoe to drop, and it dropped much sooner, Carolyn, than I suspected. Bang, his essay came on the Holocaust, which I was traveling, and I emailed you. I said, Carolyn, you know, look at that one. And I didn't even respond to that one yet because I was still simmering over the first one, which I did subsequently do a reply line item by line item to. In which my primary basis with Mr. Johnson is he is conceding all of the key points of the Jewish narrative against nationalism. And if you do that, then what else is there? Thus, his so-called new right is an empty vestibule. It contains nothing that would bind our people together in a common cause. He's basically proposing some sort of loose confederation, and it doesn't do anything, and it's for everybody. That's another thing, it's for everybody, and, you know, that's not right either. And we can get it. I don't think that's the direction we want to go for this show today.
We want to explore the relationship.
Right. Yeah. And so I think you're absolutely right, because that is the direction that Mark Weber took in 2009, and you know, that this just wasn't important. And I'm not understanding why Mark took that direction. And I wrote a reply to that, and that is essentially. My reply served for two reasons. You know, why did I pull my support from the IHR? There is the reason, and why Holocaust revisionism is important. You know, just because the lie has been around, essentially, of course, they started this big lie. There was no such thing as the Holocaust until that miniseries in the 1970s, per se. Just because the lie has been around for 30 years doesn't mean you don't, you know, stop correcting it. Doesn't mean you have to accept it.
You were still involved with Mark Weber after he wrote that essay. I mean, that
no.
probably. Oh, that was the end of it. It was that far
yeah.
back.
Yeah. No. I had retired, as I think I'd provide a chronology, and the purpose. You know, I had the opportunity to retire early, and I wanted to devote my energies to this cause. And the thing that was close, you know, where I live here.
Well, yeah.
Near, was the IHR, but and so, you know, my goal, you know, the
that
the
when was that
festival and such when, that was what? That was in 2009.
Okay.
And so anyway the idea was, you know, here's the IHR, has a tremendous, you know, resources. They had had these conferences previously, they had the Journal of Historic Review. So I thought, well, hey, you know, I have some expertise, and, you know, I was willing to make contribution. That seems, so I had to sit down and had very pleasant and positive conversations. And I want to put emphasis on conversations and discussions with Mark. And we eventually did a couple of the film festivals and such. But to put a long story short, it became fairly, you know, it became fairly clear that there wasn't any long-term vision or desire, an emphasis on desire, to reinvigorate that organization and to take it into the direction that, you know, it needed to go.
You probably because you had just gotten involved there, weren't aware of that article and the impact that it had on the revisionist community.
No.
I can understand that, because not that many people are so focused on Holocaust revisionism. They're aware of it. You know, like, you would have been aware of it, but you weren't like some kind of expert in it, where that was the focus, and you were looking at what was happening there. So that was very much a big deal in the revisionist community, but not such a big deal outside of it.
So anyway, it was very clear, and that there was not going to be a renewed direction and emphasis to rebuild. And I believe that, you know, Holocaust revisionism and really, you know, correcting the record was another term I had used at the time, was going to be the path forward. And that just wasn't going to happen. And you mesh the two. You see Mr. Johnson's emphasis, and what I've been, you know, saying to myself and to some others is, I wouldn't be surprised and watch for some sort of merger between Countercurrents and the IHR, because Countercurrents, to their credit, is publishing. They're publishing works. The IHR is not. They are philosophically on the same page. They are basically wanting to do this soft core type of okay. We'll concede the Jewish narrative. The Jews were horribly persecuted, and we'll just step over the Holocaust if you just let us alone and publish and have our deals.
I don't know about that, because IHR is not white nationalist, and I don't think it would be wanting to portray itself as white nationalist. And I don't see how Countercurrents could step away from that and still have any credibility. And I don't think it would.
I'm not sure that they're white nationalists.
You questioned the type of white nationalism, but still, that's how they present themselves. And I can't see how they would ever merge or something like that. But they do seem to be working together on some level on some issues, correct?
Yeah, well, I've gotten it. I've heard, you know, folks that have gone, who used to go, because I used to go to the monthly meetings at IHR. Of course, my understanding, I have, you know, folks that still go or had gone, that those are now bi-monthly, and that they've gone over to some of the countercurrents events with the IHR group. So there seems to be a cross-pollinization. But I wanted to get back to say where I have.
Well, that could be, yeah. And I know that at events that Countercurrents sponsors, Mark Weber is always there. But that's just him. But he might bring some of his key followers or something along with him. But that's not a big deal in itself. You know, you can do that. But it does show an affinity.
I see a lot of what we call cross-pollinization in the business, Carolyn, and that usually leads to something. I've been in the business world. I see a lot of cross-pollinization, as we say. And also, you know, beyond that, we talked about white nationalism. I think that the two essays and the podcast by Mr. Johnson, there's a term called remarket, you know, rebranding. And I think that was clearly an attempt at rebranding and moving away from this white nationalism and, you know, the term white nationalism into this very vague, you know, new right term, whatever that is.
Well, the new right is actually an attempt to include more people from the left, and to who are against immigration and can be convinced to have some a little bit more nationalist or state, you know, nation protective views, can be, you know, against this outrageous type of invasion, but they wouldn't go that far. They wouldn't go so far. And the new right, as Greg Johnson describes it, also, this is what bothers me too, is that he wants to get away from the old right, which he includes National Socialism, Fascism, any kind of state-sponsored anything. So it's kind of a libertarian type of new right. And they're, you know, where they talk a lot about individual freedom, and they don't want any of this heavy-handed old fascist-type stuff that used to exist in the old right. So this is not just a rebranding. It's a remaking of what the right is. And it welcomes a lot of elements that have been held in suspicion by
Carolyn,
us previously.
If I can stop you right there, you just made my point, I think. The new right that Mr. Johnson is proposing, and I'm not sure it's right, includes a lot of elements that are inconsistent with traditional nationalism, I think. My opinion, my one man's opinion, I think. I think that, you know, homosexuality, homosexuals, elements of the left, are just not consistent. Is this business of opening this up? And you're right. Maybe rebranding is wrong, but I think rebranding is the first step of getting people to look at it. And so that's why I reacted the way I did with that first essay, because I think it's inherently dangerous. It dilutes, creates more confusion within the nationalist community, which we do not need. I think we do need a single broader movement, but we definitely don't need a delusion of libertarians and leftists that are inconsistent with fundamental and core values, you know, of nationalism.
Well, a lot of people, some people will say, we need the big tent because you're not going to make everybody the same, and we will never have any power unless we have a larger amount of people. So you have to allow different categories of people to participate, and in their own maybe areas and groups or something. This makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. The only argument I would have against it would be that it doesn't work. You know, it's not going to work. But what would you say about it?
I agree with you. And guess what? I agree with those concepts of big tent and more groups. But guess what? What groups? Where do we draw the line? And what I'm seeing again, and I go back to the empty vestibule, we're not seeing a lot of definition on Mr. Johnson's new right. And the same applies with what happened on the IHR side. We're just not seeing a lot of definition. We're not seeing a lot of direction. We're not seeing a lot of core values. We're just seeing a lot of unknown. We're not seeing a lot of focus. We're not seeing a lot of, you know, let's just get everybody together and sing kumbaya, and but we're not seeing a lot of we're not seeing a core. We're not seeing anything like that.
Well, I don't know what we're, you know, you don't know what can be done. The point is it intellectually sound or is it not? I mean, I think that the idea sounds right, but it doesn't ever work right. And then when you said it's not traditional nationalism, well, I don't think it's meant to be. I don't think they want anything like that. And yet they're always talking about traditionalism and nationalism.
Right.
So yeah, it is a matter of talking out of both sides of mm-hmm. his mouth. And this is one thing. Let's get back to, if we can,
sure.
for just a minute,
sure.
Mark Weber and your experiences there. And
sure.
Did you complete all that, or is there some more that you can tell us?
With regard to the IHR?
Yes.
Well, let me go off there. Yeah, you know, I went there very motivated to contribute, which I did. I contributed funds. I also contributed resources. I sponsored the first two offsite IHR events, one down in San Diego.
How would you say in general, that you don't have to answer this if you don't
sure.
want. I'm nosy. I like to. What would you say in general is the amount of money that you contributed to the IHR? Of course, some of it was money that you spent in putting on events.
I sponsored the events, the two offsite events, and that was a fairly decent sum. And then I also I was consistently writing checks every month, much like a devoted Christian would put in a tithe. I'm not saying it was 10% of my income, but it was a consistent. It was a healthy amount, and enough that I claimed it on my income tax deduction. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, sure.
So
how many months were you doing this?
Consistently for about a year and a half. If I remember right. And that's Carolyn,
so
I might be off on that. Without pulling up my file, which I keep detailed files, I would say about a year and a half, year and a half, I think I would write a check a month or every month and a half or so. I could be wrong on that, but I consistently wrote. And of course, then I also bought, purchased materials there and stuff. I'm sure others were larger, grandiose contributors, but I was consistent. And because I believed that it was an organization that, had tremendous resources and potential. And, the tragedy is the lack of vision and business acumen misfocus. I think that it should be the premier organization that is combating and fighting on behalf of revisionists, as opposed to, and not to say you can't combat and write about Jewish supremacism, because in some cases you can say the two were linked, but just think of the number of revisionists right now, Carolyn, that are struggling because they're going it alone. And if they had the resources and the backing of an IHR, things would be vastly different.
Well, yeah, the IHR had some very good donors. It was very well established. And Mark Weber inherited that. And it has basically gone downhill ever since. So you can't say that, even though it was struggling before too, mm-hmm. but you can't say that his change of direction has benefited it. He's trying to portray it that way. He's trying to say, we were not getting the contributions, people were not buying our materials, but when I started talking about Zionism and Israel, Palestine, and so on, he doesn't even say what happened then. He just says that people were more interested in that and that attendance at his meetings improved or something. Well, it could be that there was a period of time when revisionism kind of went in, Holocaust revisionism, that is, kind of went into the doldrums a little bit, and nothing stays the same. And you need to do something to perk up the interest. But he didn't do that at all. So he just thought, well, what am I going to do? We're not getting enough money. So he shifted the emphasis. But I think it was more than that, because it also took the heat off of him and the IHR from people like the ADL, which we were talking about earlier. And I think that's the big motivation, a big part of the motivation,
you know,
both of these organizations are doing.
I think you're right. And I could tell you, you know, the IHR at one point, I guess, you know, 30 years ago, they did get firebombed by the Jewish Defense League, and nobody would want their
That's not when Mark Weber was in charge.
Right.
That was before him. When it was a really important,
right.
when it was really accomplishing right. something.
But, you know, I take a different view. Mark Weber may say, this is a conversation that I never had with him. We had very pleasant conversations and such. I was, you know, spent my more or less trying to persuade him to, you know, move in those more aggressive and have more events, you know, that were geared towards those type of events that would address revisionist type activities. But, for instance, you know, an IHR could have events and do things and target the next generation, like we've talked about, say, you know, go to UC Irvine and say, look, do you know how many authors are in jail for just writing a book? And you know how much curiosity
sure.
that would ignite? And they have sure. the resources and say, you know what, your college may not let you talk about it here at the student union, but come over to our place and we'll have you talk about this author that is in jail for just writing a book. You know how many kids would come and say, you know what, that just doesn't seem right. Let's go check this out. And if you can come away, if 50 students show up, Carolyn, and just two say that isn't right, we want to know more about revisionism, you've won.
Yes. Well, let me just tell you that I had an email from a nice female about a week or so ago after one of these programs. And she said, keep that up. And she was so disappointed in the IHR. And she said, why? We should do a program on what they should do is to, start a program for young people, for kids. And provide materials and so on for young people to read about Holocaust revisionism and other revisionism. And, what was that? What did she want all that? And for homeschooling parents.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that's what she thought the IHR should be doing. They could
right.
be providing all these materials and so on and the impetus for helping people to get hold of them and so on because she was so disgusted with the kind of brainwashing that goes on in the school. So the IHR should be countering that in some way. Now these are things that take work and time and all Mark Weber does, this is what really gets me, and I don't get why people continue to defend him. He just clips news items, and we're going to talk about one of those news items before we run out of time. He clips news items, and then he puts out his news and views to the email list, and that's about it, you know. And then he gives a speech now and then, and he gives a podcast once a week. That's not as difficult as people think, but there's an awful lot of people who think, well, I like his podcast, so he's doing all right with me. One podcast a week? Are you kidding me? For somebody who is the director of organization,
Carolyn,
like that?
Let me interject right there. When someone says one podcast is enough for me, that's the individual that's just doing it for entertainment. And so I don't put much weight in the person that says they're satisfied with just one podcast a week. That's not the serious person. Here's the measurement. You know, if the IHR were to, you know, swing the pendulum back and, you know, do the type of things that we've talked about. You know, how many books have Noontide Press books have the IHR actively tried to get into academic libraries and in public libraries? Maybe they have. We haven't heard about that. If they were to try and at least get the Journal of Historical Review back in the print, even if it was just quarterly or twice a year, that would make a difference. Where people like me wouldn't have to go and start their own type of organization and bring people in and start publishing out of their own pocket. I'd rather contribute to an organization that is actively doing three or four different outreach efforts to make a difference than doing it myself. I got other things to do in my retirement. I homeschool my five kids. I got other things to do. The problem is, as you well put, and we've talked about today, is there is lack of a cohesive direction in an area that really makes a difference and where they actually should be concentrating the resource. They're sitting there, that organization is sitting there with a treasure trove of resources that is essentially collecting dust and could be a resource for people that are doing it themselves. I'm talking about the revisionists, you know, that are, you know, scrapping for pennies to publish their works and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I submit to you this, Carolyn, that if the IHR tomorrow was to hold a press conference and say, we are going back into the revisionist business, we are going to be the premier resource for revisionism, we are going to get books into the public domain, we are going to be a resource for revisionists to make sure their books are published, they would see a windfall in contributions, probably. I think,
well,
so
if the IHR cooperate or associate itself with CODO, that would make more sense than to associate itself with Countercurrents.
Countercurrents to me is a waste of time. And if the IHR were to have a board of directors that consisted of revisionists such as some of the revisionists in Europe, really a serious board of directors that would provide emphasis and focus.
Well, yeah, because this board of directors, God knows what it's who these people are. But there's only six of them. Well, I think maybe one of them is Mark Weber, so there's maybe five others. But so it's not a very big board, and it's very controlled. But, you know, the first thing that has to be done is the board of directors has to get rid of Mark Weber and put somebody better in his place, and then they can start taking off, because it will never take off with him. Now, let's move on a little bit here, because I wanted us to talk about Weber's plagiarism. Well, it's probably not plagiarism, but it's his copycat-ish stuff. And we were talking about... Well, you and I, in particular, have done some programs together about the Third Reich, because this is your interest, and it's also my interest, and so we did several on the Heretics Hour, and then we did at least two together on the Christigenia Saturday radio program, and I have found that some of these programs have appeared. The subject matter and the exact content, because when you talk about certain things, I'm going to start with the one on the anti-smoking campaign in the Third Reich and the health, you know, how the Third Reich was so advanced in its health policies for the people and how it had determined that smoking was cancer causing and went on campaigned against it. To cut down on the smoking by the German people and so on, way before anybody else did it. And we did this program. It was pretty good. It was your idea. And we ventured off into a few other areas, but this was kind of the mainstay. And I remember I used the poster, one of the posters that the party put out for the artwork for that show. And then... 2 months later, Mark Weber was doing his VOR podcast, and he did a show on that. Now, that struck me because, you know, there are not that many programs of that type, and the one we did was on the Heretics Hour on VOR, and the one he did was also on VOR. So, you know, it's not like he didn't know about it, because I know from the start he had told me. I've talked about this before, so I'm going to really hurry through this. He told me that he followed my programs and he thought they were very good. This is before he started back on VOR. So, I mean, I know he knew about it, but he decided he would do that same topic. And he did it. And he used the same information, the same book about it that as someone wrote about it and so on as we did. And then we did, you noticed too, last Wednesday he did a show on Christianity in the Third Reich. And I think it was a new show, as I said. I don't remember it from before, but I've done three shows on Christianity in the Third Reich, and one of them was with you. And so not too many people have talked about that, but in his show, I didn't listen to all of it, but I noticed that it was... he didn't say anything in there, from what I listened to, that was not in our shows. Nothing new. So that sort of struck me, even though there was more time between his and the ones that we did. But then, as I told you, on Monday, he put out his, on Monday, on my Heretics Hour, I mentioned and went into fairly good amount about Walter Sanding's work on the number of missing Jews, which pointed to the fact that he concluded that there were no more than 200,000 to 600,000, probably not that low or not that high, somewhere in between, of missing Jews in World War II that could have died in the concentration camps. This is in the concentration camps. And so then I noticed yesterday, I guess, when Weber's News and Views came out, that he had decided to recommend an article from the IHR that by Walter Sanding about something a little different. But I just can't help but notice these things. Some people will say, "Oh, that's coincidence." Well, I don't think it's coincidence because other people have brought up that. Mark Weber has copied from them. And I just think that Mark Weber has very little imagination and not very many good ideas. And so when he sees something, he thinks, well, I'll do that too.
I Carolyn, if I may, I think Skype disconnected me and it got me back on, so I missed part of what you were talking about. But we're fine. But I know what we're talking about. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how it automatically puts me.
Yeah,
back
well,
it's
supposed to do that. That's something that Tan fixed up, and it's not. I don't want to test it by disconnecting people. But that's great. Good. All right.
The term that I've come up for what you're talking about with the issue with Mark's. Near identical topics on podcasts to the series. And I think it's important for the listener to understand that you and I had a series. And at one point, we even had Wilhelm Christman, who was, lived in the Third Reich and was in the Luftwaffe as an expert witness to corroborate, what we were saying. And various, and so I thought that was excellent. But we did this whole series. And to this day, and I'm sure you do, I still get emails from people regarding those podcasts. But I call it tailgating. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's plagiarism, because I will say this: I had numerous conversations with Mark, and he does have a detailed knowledge. But I do think that he senses when there's something that's a hot topic, that particularly that series is very hot, and I noticed it. I will tell you this: I noticed it, and others had brought it to my attention. When topics and very very close to identical podcasts followed ours behind, so I termed that tailgating. And did it bother me? Well, I thought it was interesting. I really did. Now I know that there's another individual that clearly has a case of really plagiarism and has exchanged emails about it. I've read them and looked at it, and it's clearly a situation where credit should have been given this individual. Mark should have probably given him credit, for the work. And I tell you what, when you spend so much time, fundraising, you tend to not do the real work of the organization. And the real work of that organization, I think should be, revisionism and Holocaust revisionism and, getting more, marshaling the resources and getting good quality writers in there and getting the revisionists in there, cranking out work and engaging in publications. So I think that the tailgating, Carolyn, that we're talking about, and I think it's rightfully so. I think it's more than a coincidence, is a result of just not having enough time to prepare and not having the vision to come up with a crafty topic. Frankly, I think you and I came up with a very crafty series, to provide what I consider intellectual meat for the listener.
And yeah, I think, to show what the Third Reich was really like.
Right.
And let me just say this while it still fits in, then you can continue. The tailgating is an excellent word, and the way I see it, but this may be just my subjective feeling. That it comes from not wanting somebody else to have done a topic about the Third Reich that he hadn't done, since he considers himself he does consider that that's part of his domain is to talk about Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich and so on in World War II. So he considers himself an expert on that. And you say he does have a lot of knowledge about it. Mm-hmm. And well, he reads tons of books, I guess.
Yes.
Too bad he can't write one. But
well, no, Mark
but,
would be
you know, I think that, that when he sees that, you know, we've done that, he says, well, I better do that too, so I have that in my repertoire. So that people wouldn't say, well, this was done by Carolyn Yeager, you know, and Ronnie Martin, but it would be, well, this was done, here's the one done by Mark Weber. It's kind of a competitive thing. It's instead of working with people, well, maybe I haven't been willing to work with him, but it's kind of a, well, I have never seen somebody else do a program and say, oh, and I say, oh, I want to do something on that myself. I have never done that.
Well, I can tell you this, Carolyn. Let me share something that I think is maybe comparison. I found, you know, Mr. Walsh in the UK had written some powerful essays about everyday life in the Third Reich and correcting the record, you know, revisionism about, you know who'd started World War II and the roots of World War II. And I really wanted to, you know, use that information. I thought, well, you know, use it. Let me just write him and ask him if we can, you know, use his work. And I wrote him and explained to him what my organization was all about and all that. And he graciously accepted and said, you know, use any of my work you want. Post it on there. And he
his work to be posted.
Yeah,
right.
And he went a step further. He thanked me for having the courtesy of asking him first. Apparently, there's been a pattern around circles of just grabbing his work and posting it.
Oh, yeah, he's complained about that, and I believe he is telling the truth that people do that, yeah.
Yes, and so, you know, I think that there should be, but like I say, I do believe what's happened with us is on particularly that Third Reich series is there was some tailgating, but I think also there has been, I think one individual has been aggrieved with regard to absolute plagiarism, I think that I think a person does have some grievance with some plagiarism. I'm not going to speak for that individual, but I think it's well known.
Oh, somebody who's
yes,
who feels that Weber has plagiarized him.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Okay,
you know that?
All right.
Yes, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well,
so
all right. So it's, yeah, it's like an issue that's come up before.
Yes, it has. It has come up. You know, besides just you and I. And it's too bad. I go back to my fundamental premise: is the IHR is an organization and a structure that has tremendous, you know, assets, intellectual assets, you know, in terms of inventory and such that has been developed over time, many of which developed prior to the tenure of Mark. It has all of these assets and resources and structure. And it's essentially so grossly underutilized that it is an intellectual catastrophe, and it needs to.
Yeah, and it also has a reputation that just won't go away.
Well,
you know,
I mean,
no matter what Weber has done, he hasn't destroyed the reputation of the IHR. I mean, because it was so well established.
Classic example, Carolyn, is myself. When I retired in 2009, I wanted to find some place to contribute to, interact with, and I went there and, you know, spent, you know, about a year, you know, even wanted and started the, you know, the film festival side, which they still do occasionally, not along the, you know, the level that I wanted to do there, but they still do it. And, you know, I became, you know, said this is a waste of time because there's clearly you're going to continue along this very limited focus of raising just what I consider best minimal performance, raising just enough funds to keep the doors open and, you know, pay the salaries of the support staff that are there and to basically best minimal and then go forward and have their monthly meetings or their every monthly meetings and that's it. And if that's a result of being shell-shocked by the ADL, that's a tragedy because I think in this day and age they should double down and engage and really reach out because I think advantage would reap enormous advantage. But I just don't think that the vision and the business acumen is there.
No, it isn't at all. Now that's supposed to be taken up by the board of directors.
Yeah, well,
I don't know that they do. I mean, it's also secretive. I mean, they talk about this organization, and there's only one person paid there, that's Mark Weber, so there's obviously no employees anymore.
Well, they used to have.
And if they are, they're volunteer. Now, I mean, I know there's some people doing things there, but they do on a volunteer basis.
Yeah. Well, they used to have two, actually. They had Mark and they had an assistant there. And actually, the assistant left and went to, I believe, graduate school. And they did post, you know, they were going to hire that. But that was just a part-time visit. But I think recently, because of the enormous amount or the increased volume of fund appeals, I think now it's just Mark, because you call there and you just get the answer machine. Because, you know, I attempted to call there not too long ago because I wanted to explain myself, you know, be honorable and say, this is the reason why I stopped funding that, you know, sending the checks. This is why I started my own organization. This is why I wrote this, you know, the rebuttal essay and what I did. And all I got was an answer machine three times. And they were during business operations, business hours.
Yeah. Well, okay, this brings up an interesting question, which is very good because I had kind of run out of things for the end here. And that is funding. You know, I've been told by some who say, boy, you should not get on your radio program and discourage people from sending money to any organization that's working on behalf of white people or white causes in any way. That's so wrong. Because, you know, the Jews have all this millions and billions of dollars and we don't have hardly any, and to encourage people not to. Well, but the question I'm going to ask here is, should the IHR continue to be funded? Mark is sending out all these fundraising letters, as you know, you mentioned. And should it, or would the best thing be not to fund it? You know, I mean, I'm willing to say, boy, I've been wrong about all this, and, you know, but I've just got carried away or something. But, you know, my feeling is if something is not doing what it should do, we should stop funding it, and then something will be made right about it. The directors are the ones that would have to make that decision. They're not making it.
Well, the two lines of thought, Carolyn, on that is one, you know, could you, who are the board of directors now and how would you contact them? And are they a true board of directors? And let me give you a parable, you know.
Well, they're on those IRS. See, because Weber, IHR is a 501c3, which you know.
Right.
They have to have that, but you don't get to see it for like 2 years after their first file. So I don't know what that is all about, but they're not made public until later. So so we don't know for the last 2 years, say, but you know, they show and they are listed there, and I think even their addresses have to be listed there. So the thing is, I'm just saying it's the job of the board of directors to see that the place stays solvent. But if they're not doing that, but, you know, what about the funding? Should an organization that has that, let's say you and I, the way we feel about it, the way we see it, I mean, I wouldn't send any money to it, and you've stopped. So what about other people? Should people be discouraged?
Here is what my train of thought when I decide to give money to organizations or any organization is what's called ROI, return on investment. Is this organization engaging in meaningful, emphasis on meaningful activities that are furthering the true cause? Are they actually producing anything? And in the case of the IHR, I had to stop and look. Are they producing anything? Are they publishing? The answer turned out to be no. Are they amenable to, you know, moving and engaging in any meaningful change to, you know, reinvigorate the organization? The answer was no. Yes, they adopted my film festival presentation, which I presented them in an outline, but they watered it down to where it was meaningless and couldn't attract anything else. That couldn't attract a broader audience. And so my advice is if you're going to donate to an organization, you have to look at, is it really truly returning anything? Is it really making any meaningful advances as opposed to just existing? And just existing is not a basis for making a donation, particularly by those who, you know, donors, people who are struggling themselves. Your donation should be conditional. When you donate money, it should be conditional. It should be conditional upon, you know, progress and continual progress and advancement of the cause. So, you know, what I would like to see, Carolyn, is people write to the IHR's board and say, I would be willing to contribute under the following circumstances. And list your circumstances. Get the Journal of Historic Review return, get new leadership in that is dynamic and innovative and returns it to a revisionist emphasis and moves forward. Now, is that going to happen?
There's just some people out there, there's some people out there in California, in Orange County, who go to some of those meetings that they have. And drink the booze, which you didn't get a chance to talk about all the booze.
I'll talk about that now.
Okay, and do all this, and maybe give a few dollars. I forgot where I was going with that. But they're not asking the right. They're not demanding anything. That's what I was going to say. They're just saying, well, this is okay. I went to a meeting. It was real good. And Mark talked, and we saw a film, and we drank some beer and maybe something else, and it was good, and that's all they're satisfied.
Well, let me share that. If people are just satisfied with having a meeting once a month or every other month so you can come and have happy hour and just talk and preach to the choir and you don't have, and you're not at least increasing your organization or your audience at least 20 to 25% every time, you're a failure. If you're just interested in preserving your status quo and existing, you're a disservice.
Well, that's what Mark Weber has been doing ever since he took over, is preserving his position there. Seems to me, especially in the last few years. Now, Rodney, you would be great on the board of directors. I was thinking you should. Now, what if they had somebody, had you there? You wouldn't have to be the director, but you could have some position there. And if they had a director who was a real you might not be too bad, a real go-getter, somebody with ideas and so on, and then had a few people like that. But even if you were just a director, you would invigorate so much what was going on there. And that's what's wrong.
The dream board of directors, Carolyn, for the IHR would be Gamal Rudolph, would be Robert Ferrisson. You want core, committed revisionists who have a record, who have been baptized.
Well, they wouldn't have to be the actual revisionists. Like Robert Forreston is probably too old and not in good enough health. But you wouldn't have to be revisionists, but they would have to be people like you who know how things are supposed to function and who would be pushing for something happening, not this dead place. It's shameful. And that's why I keep talking about it. We're almost out of time, but not quite. I'm going to let you end it. But, that's why I keep talking about it, because when I think about it, it just makes me sick, and it's such a waste. And why should I worry about Mark Weber's feelings? That's what I When he's not worried about the whole cause that's going on, although he pretends he is.
We need not be worried about the emotionalism and hold back on constructive criticism. And Carolyn, I consider everything we've talked about today as constructive criticism. I want to see the IHR grow and succeed and be the premier revisionist resource center for the world. And so everything I've said has been intended to be constructive criticism. And the situation in the IHR, as I said, is a tragedy, and I hope it's taken and such. If not, if people have an emotional reaction, that's a reflection of them and not you or I.
Well, thank you. I think so too, and that is the bottom line here. I hope I've been constructive. I probably didn't always sound real constructive, but that is my intention is to say what I think needs to be said, whether it's constructive or not. I think it needs to be said. So I want to thank you, Rodney Martin, once again for being on my program. You did a great job, as you always do. And I know the listeners, we had quite a lot of listeners tonight, today. It's afternoon, actually. And so and more people will be listening to it. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in today, and come back next week for another Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyeager.com.